options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
Ken, thank you very much for hosting me here today. I really appreciate it. So we're going to dive right in. As some of the people watching this know, but you perhaps not, my prior guest in this series that we're doing, CIO Corner, was my longtime friend Bob Kyle, that I went to law school with. And he's, like you, a master communicator. And he said, look, the secret to good communication, whether you're giving a speech or doing something like this, is just make the first 30 seconds really count. Ideally, by diving into a really compelling story that really grabs your audience. So I'm going to do that right now. And I'm going to do it by, because I often get asked, and you probably do too from time to time, like, what's the most memorable day in your whole career? And of course, for me, it is 9/11. Maybe we can come back to that. But a close second was a certain day in July of 1999, when I was in a room where something very important happened. And you were actually at that site, which was Las Campanas in Santa Fe, New Mexico. But you were not permitted to be in the room that I was in when something important happened. I'm going to just stop right there and let you at whatever length you like.
Are you saying that was an important moment in your life?
Yes. Yeah.
We got to
second
back.
Most memorable day in my career. So go ahead and tell the audience what happened day in New Mexico with all the backstory associated.
Well, there's a whole chapter in my book on it, which is way more detailed. It's interesting that you think it was memorable. It was only memorable after the fact when I talked to people about it. Backstory is we had a really bad investment set of circumstances that happened from 1994-5 through into 1998. And we had made a series of investments with a great management team, doing all the things that we were built to do and that we were executing on, which was feeding our winners, good people, hard workers. They make a deal. The deal works. They find another one. We fund it. They find that one works. We find the third one that we fund it. All going great, right? And as we build confidence and we build momentum, you know, my mantra was feed the winners. And it's so much easier to do that than to sit there and spend all the time with underperformers. Their last bite at the apple was a huge one, and they first deal was plus or minus 30 million, then a 60, then 100. And they were all working. And then they wanted to do this $500 million deal, Canadian dollars. And it was a publicly traded company that they wanted to go after. And in Canada, there are relatively liberal procedures. If you have a bid and you put a company, an offer in front of a company, they have a period of time to shop it, but it really becomes an inevitability if you're the highest bidder. So, long story short, we lined up the bank financing. And we were ready to close the deal. And as the calendar struck, it was a two-part transaction to buy the equity of the target company. And then once we had control of the equity, we could consolidate our company with theirs and refinance the debt. We had our lender in place, which, at the time was, Chase. And on September 2nd, they funded half the money, which they had committed to us, to match with our equity. To buy the equity of the target. We were successful in the tender offer, and we bought 97% of the shares had been tendered. And on 2 days later, we were going to then take the rest of the money on our bank facility and combine the two and cash out the last 3%. Chase funded the first half of the money on September 2nd, and they did not fund the second half of the money. It was not a two-tranche loan. It was a... It was just because we only needed half the money on Tuesday, not on Thursday. We called up Chase and they said, well, we want to do further due diligence. I said, what are you talking about? And they said, well, we don't think that we're going to fund the second half of the money. Unrelated to us, what was happening at the time, almost to the week, was the major money center banks were holed up in New York at the Fed working on the long-term capital management hedge fund that rumor has it needs to be recapitalized or else it's going to bring down the global financial system. The second thing was happening about at the same time, Russia was threatening to default on their debt, and that was another shock to the system. And so the banks basically said, stop. Oil prices had collapsed, which had created our opportunity. And so we weren't disgruntled about that, but it was my first, one of my early lessons that what happens over there matters here. And we were now, unbeknownst to me, a victim of what was happening in the world. Despite commitments fees paid and underwriting letters and all the rest. So long story short, we ended up having to buy 97% of the company. We never were able to consolidate the two. And this company immediately went into workout. And we had a decision to make. We tried and tried and tried. We wanted to hedge the oil, couldn't because we had no bank credit. And this went through from the fall of 98 all the way through the winter. I sent two people full time to Calgary. We were working on it day and night. And Chase was continued. They were, because we were such a good client, they were in this mindset, let's just rework the structure. We'll be able to syndicate. Rework the structure. We'll be able to syndicate it. Meanwhile, oil prices slide. The financial issues still persist. Complicating that factor was we were in the market raising another fund. And we had a really strong track record. The problem is this problem company was representing 20% of the fund that we were investing.
Biggest fund you'd ever made.
Biggest bet you'd ever, by far. Yeah. And we were doing all the right things. When we got to the winter, we turned off the management fee related to that deal. We were transparent with our investor base, et cetera. Fast forward to the summer of 99, and we're having our investor meeting, which you referenced in Santa Fe, which was where we did that on odd years. And we went through all of our returns and all of our market analysis. And then I had said, we had a few threshold decisions to make. Number one, were we going to be in the lawsuit business? We could have shut down our business and basically decided to sue Chase.
Mm-hmm.
And we had been out of business, but we'd be in the lawsuit business. Maybe that's a huge lawsuit. Maybe we win, maybe we lose, who knows? But we had to make that decision. The second decision was, what do we do with our portfolio? Are we paralyzed or not? And the third was, what do we do with our new fund? Because if this is going to be a total write-off, you know, we have people who've signed subscription agreements for based on our track record. So first decision, we're not going to be in the lawsuit business. I don't believe that that's the way you approach it. Chase was never not transparent with us. They had exogenous factors. We had exogenous factors, and we were still continuing to work together. Doesn't mean we weren't aggressive towards them, not from a legal standpoint, but saying, you know, we are still expecting you to keep working on it, which they did. What about our business? You know, nobody cheated, nobody lied, nobody stole. And in fact, one of the silver linings from this deal was that the management team that we had invested in essentially had their equity wiped out was still working hard. And that alignment that we built as an investment principle of making sure that our manager team has skin in the game and not just an options package. If they had an options package that was out of the money, it would have been rational for them to just throw the car keys at us and say, y'all deal with it. But we stayed in there and we worked hard, but nobody cheated, nobody lied, nobody stole. It just didn't work. And there were lessons to learn from that. But we said, you know what? The same dynamic that is hurting this company are creating opportunities over here and over here and over here and over here. We did not take it as an indictment of ourselves, our skills, or our business. We just said, this one got picked. I mean, the window closed and their fingers were in the window. And that's what happened. Okay, now what do we do with the fund? Well, we went through all of our numbers at our annual meeting, and I said, you know what? Throw it open to the audience. Just, you know, I said, it's their money. It's not our money. And if people, if they hear the story and they want to back out, let them back out. There were certain investors that said they have a stronger allegiance to their bank than they do to our money.
They're not said that of you.
They said it of us.
Yeah. Critical way.
Yeah, yeah, very critical. And I'm like, we're working our tails off on this. And we've turned off the management fee. Lost it.
Proactively and voluntarily.
Proactively. Yeah. You know, I mean, we did not have to do that.
Yeah.
I just said, you know, we're not going to not do the right thing. So what's the right thing? And then I said, you know what? If people are disgruntled, let's let them decide. And so at our annual meeting, we concluded the meeting with a discussion of this company, soup to nuts. And we said, you know what? We have $450 million of subscription agreements for our next fund. We will open it up. And if people want to tear up their subscription docs, we'll let them. And if people think we're not being fair and honest and open, you know what? We try to be communicating with everybody, but some people were hearing this for the first time. Other people were diving in. So we said, you know what? We're going to leave the room and let you guys talk about us.
Which we did.
You know, so yeah. But to me, I didn't think anything of it. I mean, we're just making this up as we went along. Nobody told me to do this.
Yeah.
I just said, what would be the thing that if I was on the other side of the table, I'd want?
Yeah.
You know? And so we presented it and we walked out and we said, I walked out with my partners and we said,
went right to the bar.
We went, you know, and I said, wait a minute, you know, we're footing the bill in there and they're out there, they're behind this, they're back in this room. But again, it was just one of these things that I told people later, they said, you let your LPs just, first of all, many funds don't tell their LPs who each other are.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, they don't. The last thing they want is them comparing notes. But this is the days before side letters and special. This was a very young part of the private equity industry.
Yep.
In the mid 90s, this industry was just getting its footing. I didn't think I was doing anything that revolutionary.
Yeah.
And I did, you know, ask one of our CEOs to stay in.
Phil Smith.
Phil Smith, who's a good friend. And I said, I'd like you to stay in. And if people ask questions, you know about our business plan, you know about other portfolio companies, you know what we're doing. We had done the Mesa transaction already. Phil was on the board of that. And we were also invested with him. And so I said, you know us as well as anyone on a personal level and professional level. If people question about how our firm runs, just answer them. I mean, I wasn't afraid of the truth in any way, shape, or form. And it was a really liberating feeling of just being so brutally truthful. You don't ever have to remember anything if you're always telling the truth.
Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Well, here we are years later, and I said to you 10 minutes ago, this is one of the most memorable days of my career, because when you left the room, I stayed, right? Because I was running TIFF at the time, and we had a major stake in major for us in the funds, the early funds, as well as a commitment to NGP6. And what unfolded after you guys left the room was really the full spectrum of human nature, right? People that looked at it, in my view, at contemporaneously and in hindsight, in a very clear-headed, logical, sensible way, taking due note of the fact that oil prices had absolutely collapsed. So as Rainwater said many times to you personally, never to me because I never had the privilege of meeting Richard, in chaos lies opportunity. Why under those circumstances would you ever renege or withdraw a commitment to a fund that's perfectly positioned to exploit that chaos? So, but you did have people in the room who were, in fact, did vote that way because you went from 450, as I recall, to 370 in committed capital.
And the next fund was a 7.5x money fund. So that $80 million was about worth $600 million.
The counterfactual
that Peter would pull out. And the, what's interesting, I, you know, I think it's a good lesson because both sides of the argument were entirely logical for to say, listen, these guys had a huge blind spot. They missed it. They couldn't, you know, work their way out of it. We're going to pull out. And people were gentlemen about it. You know, people say we're going to wait and see how you do. And, you know, other people were saying there's opportunity here. The questions on the investment side to have asked were, are these guys still committed? Okay. Did we have one foot out the door? Were we just trying to see how the future was going to work out?
Yeah.
Or were we in with both feet with something to prove?
Yeah.
There is nothing better than to back somebody who's got something to prove.
You bet.
And we had something to prove.
Yeah.
And anyway, so, you know, we were still aligned. We lost not only a bunch of money personally, but we lost we had a reputation risk.
Yeah.
And again, you combine that with good people, you know, I put myself in that category as a good person that doesn't want to let people down. Yeah. And I care more about losing other people's money than my own money.
Absolutely.
And those are the questions, you know, I get a kick out of people that come in and do due diligence on funds and, you know, they want to tear into every single deal and correlate it to this and correlate to that. I'm like, those are the wrong questions to ask.
Entirely.
Who are the people behind it? Are your interests aligned? Are they motivated? You know, and what drives them? What are they passionate about? Those are the kinds of things. And if you applied those questions, looking at the three of us leaving the room, what better commitment signaling do you need than we basically threw ourselves at the mercy of the court?
You did. That's a perfect segue to where I want to go next. Because I know the people are going to be watching this conversation now, we're 12 or 13 minutes into it, and say, wait a minute, who is this guy, Ken Hirsch? And what's the firm he's referring to? Like, when did it get started? It must have been a young guy because you're not that old still. So let's go back and fill in a little bit of the backstory. Sure. And I'll ask you to do so against the context of the following, that now in hindsight, we can see that you all at what was Natural Gas Partners, the day it was first founded, that was the firm's name, and eventually became NGP Energy, really pioneered a model. And I think deserve, you would never claim this because you're very humble, but I can shower this accolade on you and the folks who built the team and pulled it off. You really transformed the oil and gas industry in the United States in a way that, as we can come back to at the end when we talk about geopolitics, has made, I think, a really lasting contribution, not only to America, but to democratic capitalism. That sounds like a very bold and sweeping claim, but that's my opinion, which I'm careful to label as such. But take 3 or 4 minutes, go back to actually with your days with Richard, with Rainwater, and the firm's founding. 3 or 4 minutes will suffice, and then I want to dive into the culture that you experienced at Rainwater and what you built at NGP.
Okay. So trying to do it in 3 or 4 minutes is tricky. Back in after the deregulation of the natural gas industry, the collapse of oil prices in the late 80s and the change of the tax laws in 1986, where the promoter's paradise of raising money for syndicated drilling deals wasn't as lucrative, created an opening because there was a real capital drought in the energy business. At the same time, because of the capital drought, there was no drilling. If there's no drilling, then supply falls, right? At the same time, prices get cheap and demand goes up, all right? So Richard commandeered a study from McKinsey on the natural gas industry that they were out there trumpeting that supply is doing this and demand is doing this in the late 80s and prices were going to go from here to here. So Richard said, let's put some money together that's going to get long natural gas and just play it'll be a 3-year deal. We'll buy low, we'll sell high, we'll find something else to do. I, at the same time, had written him a cold call letter for a summer job between my years of business school. I was just looking for a job. I never knew it. I was in the energy group at Morgan Stanley as an analyst, so I knew enough to be dangerous. But I found myself in Richard Rainwater's office the afternoon of the morning that McKinsey had been in his office to present his study. He looks at me and says, I'm so glad to meet you, but I have no summer jobs. And I said, I came all this way. Then he said, he looked on his desk and he had this blue McKinsey book and he spun it around. And he said, hey, but you were in the energy group. What do you think of this? So I took it. I'm 25 years old, which is amazing. I flip it and see what it, you know, the supply and demand charts, and it says prices are going to go up. Trying to think on my feet with nothing to lose, I close the book. I said, tell you what, Richard. I'm like, Richard, if somebody did this to me today, I'd be like, are you kidding me? I said, tell you what, Richard, how about for my summer job, I take the McKinsey view of the world and write a strategy piece on who would win and who would lose and how you'd put money. And he said, make me a proposal. So I made him a proposal and he bid on it. And so that was part of my summer job. I worked at McKinsey in the morning during the day, and at night I moonlit out of their Dallas office, putting this study together for Richard. Richard then, at the end of the summer, he made a phone call to Dick Jenrette, who was the chief investment officer at the Equitable Insurance Company. And he said, we got this great thesis. We've done all this work. Why don't you come down? In September of 88, he sent his investment team down to Fort Worth. The second time I was in Rainwater's office presenting my study. But I didn't present my study because there were a bunch of suits in the room. And I had brought about 20 books because I had been caught shorthanded a week earlier. It went on only three notebooks to present my study, and he had too many people in the room. So I had about 20 of these things stacked up. And here I am, 25 years old. I look like I'm 12 with notebooks like this and a big long table. And Richard stands up at one end and draws two lines, supply and demand. And he says, we got this study from McKinsey. And he says, and we've done all this work. And then everybody's looking at me and I'm at the table. You can't even see me. And those books could have been the phone book. Because they were so thick, they didn't crack. But that was in September of 88. Documents started flying. And on November 16th, 1988, Natural Gas Partners was born. Okay, a partnership to invest in natural gas. We didn't spend a lot of money on naming consultants. And that was it. They wired us $97.5 million with an 11% meter. This was before the days of private equity. And so we had this wall of preference coming at us on day one. We had to figure out what to do. Easy. Let's get long companies that are leveraged to natural gas prices, kind of do debt with warrants and mezzanine kind of investments that will benefit from rising prices, but be structured. Well, we did that for a couple of years. The McKinsey thesis, dead wrong. Gas prices went down for seven straight years. And we ended up with four or five companies. Some were doing okay and some weren't. So we stopped. In 1991, we stopped and said, and this is for the getting to the answer of your question. Now I'm probably going more than 3 or 4 minutes. Why did the companies that are doing well or good enough, why are they doing okay when prices are down? And why are the other companies, our other investments, not? Well, I can tell you why the ones that weren't doing well weren't doing well is because they were just levered bets on gas prices and gas prices are going down. Forget that. The ones that were doing well were good management teams who knew how to make lemonade out of lemons and were taking the other parts of the equation. You know, this is not rocket science. I'm not a geologist. I'm not a petroleum engineer. This business is not that hard. It's price times volume minus costs, and that's it. Okay, if your prices are going down every year, just stick it in the model. And how do you make it up? You can make it up by lowering costs or improving volume. So let's try to find people who can lower costs and improve volume. And that took us into a model of backing management teams. We said, why do we need assets? And this is where a couple competitors thought we were nuts. If the assets that are there today are going to deplete in 7 years, then what we have to sell when we exit this is what that management team did with our money and the free cash flow off the existing assets.
Sure.
But if you're plus or minus 10% off the free cash flow, it's not going to matter if you found a great management team that knows how to acquire assets, drop costs from the prior owner, increase volumes around the edges, and do that over time. The power of compounding really works.
Yeah.
So I said, let's just start doing that. And we flipped the model more to an executive recruiter headhunter.
Yeah, to talent.
Let's find great people. Let's do what Rainwater always said. Align your interests with great people that you would trust with your kids. And that's the starting point. And then if you do that, and they are great petroleum engineers, and they are great geologists, you don't have to be.
Yeah.
Right? And all we can do is be the best partner we can be and help them kind of on the right side of the balance sheet. And the model just took off. And people would look at us and go, they have no engineers on staff. How can they possibly make any money? Like, I don't want engineers on staff. I want to back great engineers. And we'll spend our time making sure they're great engineers and geologists. So that once we did that, it was so liberating. And it really allowed us to focus on what drives value, and that is between the ears.
Yeah.
And that has now become the investment model, the energy.
Yeah. And because I was, you know, had a front row seat to a lot of it, I can say that that very vibe and aversion to having highly trained consultants provide the answer was very appealing to the institutional allocators who themselves were tautologically generalists.
Right.
So there was a comfort in that.
Right.
Yeah.
And so how do you, as a generalist, how do you make money in a specifically targeted focused area? Yeah.
In a highly technical
industry. Yeah, in a highly technical industry. Yeah. Well, the last thing that we should do is try to shift the technical know-how to our side of the table.
You don't have an inch.
And we don't have, I can't have a staff, you know, and that's, we saw that. And commercial banks make that mistake, and other investment firms were making that mistake, because they would have an engineer who, a petroleum engineer, who would be a, you know, a mid-continent gas engineer during the day, and then tomorrow they're an offshore oil engineer, and then the next week they're an offshore West Africa engineer. I mean, these are, you know, these basins are hundreds of millions of years apart geologically. How can I be an expert on all of them, you know, and because my expertise is on my payroll, you treat it like gospel.
Yeah.
And here's a team who lives and breathes that field, and they've lived it, and they know how those wells produce, and they know the characteristics, and they've been working that field for 10 years, and you're going to spend 2 hours or spend a long weekend and come back and you say, my guy says you're off by 20%. I thought that was completely backwards. And not being a technical person allowed me to kind of say that. I mean, and David Alban also, I mean, the fact that we weren't technical was the greatest strength. I used to run a chart of IRR versus engineers, us versus competitors. And of course, we had zero engineers, so we had an infinite number. And our returns were better than those firms that staffed up with engineers.
Yeah.
And one by one by one, our other competitors in the oil and gas private equity space changed their business models one by one by one, to a point at the peak, there were probably 40 firms that were in the business of identifying management teams, giving them equity lines of credit to go out and shop.
Yeah, your model.
And that model.
Mimicking that model. Yeah.
And it drove the capital availability to the independent oil and gas space. And this is to your last part of your question, just for those people out there. The unconventional shale revolution was not brought to you by Exxon and Chevron and Conoco. Okay, they were all poo-pooing it at the time and going off into far-off places. Now they've all come back. But it was brought to you by the independent oil and gas producers who were experimenting and trial and error, et cetera. And they needed capital. They needed the rule of law because they had property rights and mineral rights. And they had that experimental gene of not being afraid of failure to try something new. And the combination of hydraulic fracturing with horizontal drilling,
which was started 30 miles
from where we were, by George Mitchell. Yeah. But once one or two people happened or did it, then everybody wanted to replicate it and try it out everywhere. Yeah. And we needed the capital to do it.
So let's go back. I want to double click on what I'm going to call culture. It's going to be a two-part question about the culture of the Rainwater Organization and the culture that you built at NGP. And I'm going to do so mindful that our audience comprises, not exclusively, but dominantly investment professionals or other individuals, very savvy men and women, who are themselves in the fortunate position of evaluating investment professionals. So they should, and many of them do, think a lot about organizational culture. And you've thought about it a lot. You and I have discussed it at length over the years, and you've written about it too. The two-part question is, when you look at what happened at Rainwater, that it's like a coaching tree, right? Look at the firms, including NGP, Lone Star, TPG, that came out of the Rainwater organization. Was that nature, nurture, or a combination of the two? The nurture would have been from Richard grooming young people like you to do better.
Yeah.
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager-in-chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40-plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high-conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe and tune in live to The Call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
That's a great question. And there are a lot of other in the lineage than the few you just mentioned.
Yeah.
I'd say it's a lot of nature.
Hiring the right people.
Well, he never hired us. The truth is that very few, I mean, Peter Juice was probably the only person who actually drew a paycheck from Richard Ringer. You know, he was cheap.
Yeah.
When we did the CNBC tribute to him when he got sick in 2015, we were all sitting around the green room. It was John Phelan and Eddie Lampert and John Goff and myself and Dan Stern and Barry Sternlicht. And everybody had similar stories. Well, I came to see Richard and he said I would do something with him, but he never paid me. You know, I had to do my own stuff. I mean, I had the NGP fund that was paying. So Richard, but the culture, here's what we all had in common. Number one is we were all people who raised our hands. We all had the same story. At one point, mine was closing that McKinsey book and said, tell you what, Richard, okay? Other people had a very similar one, okay? And these were, we were all just a little bit bold enough to say, hey, what about me? Okay. And number one, Richard was willing to listen to that for a bunch of young people. We were young at the time. And if you look at what Richard would let us use his name and fly his flag, that was valuable. Let us office here, you know, and it was a confederacy. And it was a confederacy of young capitalists who all were talking in the hallways. And, you know, John Goff describes it as every day was like a pickup basketball game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody would have a deal and say, hey, get in here, you know, and let's chat about it. And it didn't matter if you were Rick Scott next to me in the office next to me working on hospital deals,
mm-hmm.
or John Goff around the corner looking at some real estate, or, you know, it just didn't matter. Everybody was doing something. Ad Kelly looking at some energy service deals and Peter Juice looking at some workout. I mean, it was crazy. And I was doing energy. But it was a widget. And so it was, to us, it was just that culture of creating this sort of confederacy where people could say, hey, what if we did this? And Richard was really good about making sure that, because when he was in the room, he would say, well, what about the manager? He was just pounding. What about the management team? What about the management team? And he was always good to say, just because you guys are smart, you're not going to run the company. They're going to run the company.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, you know, and I've modified that a little bit to say, I don't want the 2 a.m. phone call.
Yeah.
I want the 9 a.m. phone call from the person that says I was up all night. I took care of it.
I call it the broken wing.
Okay.
Right. Exactly.
And
yeah.
That's who we want.
Mm-hmm.
And can we align our interests with great people? And Richard would say, think big. Mm-hmm. And that's what Richard, we were a bunch of young people. And he would say, well, let's, you know, what's going on in the airlines industry? Nancy, get Bob Crandall on the phone. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, Ken, you need to listen to this because they deal with that one energy all the time. I'm like, I'm on the phone with Bob Crandall. You know, he's the CEO of American Airlines. You know, and it was just that way.
Yeah.
So you combine the nature of people who were inclined to be bold with somebody who said it's okay. I think that was the magic of it.
Yeah.
And it was at a time where the industry was less formed. And so we were able to kind of make it up as we went along.
Yeah.
We made it really fast.
So now let's explore the same challenge at NGP. Before you answer that or address it, I'll say that one of the most memorable comments you've ever made to me was when you said, it's vain, foolish, and impossible to perpetuate exactly as it's originally created an organizational culture, because as you add people to it, again, tautologically, the culture will change.
Right.
Your role as the leader is to shape the evolving culture,
right,
not to perpetuate or keep it frozen in time forever.
Right.
But speak to that. What did you try to do at the outset with NGP? How many principles came over from Rainwater? And then describe in a few minutes again how it evolved over time.
Correct. And what you're saying is, you know, I do a lot of reverse engineering now to see, and
yeah,
culture is an output, not an input.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's, if you try to say, this is our culture, we're a bunch of really giving, inclusive people. And then you hire somebody who's not giving and not inclusive. Guess what? Your culture is not giving and inclusive. Or you just pound that person and say, you have to fit into our mold right now.
Sounds,
and it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Okay. So you bring new people in and your culture is now this amoeba that now has shape, new shape. So that, and that is clear. This is where NGP was different than Rainwater Inc. Richard bragged that he had no employees. He bragged that he could put his whole balance sheet on a note card. You know, of course, he had an other line that had about 30 things on it, but we'll leave that aside. But he wanted simplicity. You know, he would say, Ken, you spend the first part of your life complicating it, and the last part of your life simplifying it. You know, I'm a builder. And so what I discovered with David Alban and with John Foster and Gamble is the four of us were the four original people that Richard kind of pushed us together and said, y'all do it. Okay. And that was it. And then we added people because of more of my personality than David's. David was in Greenwich, Connecticut, and I was in Fort Worth. Magically, our general partner of the partnership of Natural Gas Partners, the general partner was GFW Energy, which stood for Greenwich Fort Worth. You know, again, no naming consultancy. But I said, why don't we have these people in Dallas or Fort Worth? And it's, you know, we can recruit here and it's closer to the oil patch, et cetera. And that was more my personality. Mm-hmm. So I started building and adding people. And the first thing you do is you add young analysts and associates who can really help with the deal processing. And it was a club. And it wasn't, we weren't an organization, we were a club.
Yeah.
But once we got more size to us and more scale, I started to have to answer the questions, what are we going to be as we grow up, not when we grow up? And what I discovered is a few things. I mean, again, this is not rocket science, but it was just common sense. There's no separation between business and person. We spend more of our waking hours with our people in the office than we do with our families. And so you better like them. You better want to hang out. You better want to have a beer with them if you're stuck at the airport. All that stuff that is pretty commonplace today, we were learning. And we were making sure that we had people. I always wanted to make sure I was surrounded by people who wanted to win, who were used to winning or working hard to win, you know, competitive in nature, that wouldn't accept failure as an option. And this goes back to the answer to the first question. You know, it was never a doubt that we were going to quit the firm. We had to see if our money wanted to quit, but we weren't going to quit.
Yep. Yep.
In fact, we were going to double down on our effort to make sure that the next fund was the best fund ever.
Yeah.
So I think that part of that culture of excellence and, you know, that became our culture. And I believe it to this day that the way to create a great corporate culture is to feed your winners. And if you are always, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. If you're always coddling to the employee or the partner who's griping all the time, you know, what does that, and you start accommodating, and what does that say to the high performers, the people who are just going about their job, mm-hmm. doing it great, happy to work there? They'd sit there and they go, wait a minute, you know, I'm here killing it, and this other person's getting all this time and attention. So along the way, I mean, I learned this the hard way in some cases, that if you feed your winners, people-wise, with a couple caveats. One, they have to be real winners. Mm-hmm. Okay, you can't have fake metrics, and they have to. They can't be winners just because they were in the same fraternity, or they look like you, or they sound like you. They have to be real winners. As a leader, you have to make sure they're a real winner. But if you sit there, somebody is doing a great job and finishes early, and they want more responsibility, I want to hand it to them, and I want to make it known that I handed it to them.
Yeah.
I want to celebrate that.
Yeah.
This is what happened. Number one is other people start to model that behavior and say, I want to be in that winner circle. Now, other caveat, you can't have a quota.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You want everybody to be a winner.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Those two are the caveat. No quota. So I want to be in that winner circle, and they up their game. Other people say, you know what? I don't have the time or bandwidth to do that, but I'm happy to support it. That's good too. And then there's some people who say, this is unfair. How come they're getting all the attention? I'm out of here. That's okay too. You do all those. If you do that, what has just happened? Your average performance of your organization just went up.
Sure.
And so I see so many times that people just, they get sucked into the vortex of people who are energy sappers, and they spend all this time and attention trying to coach up the bottom. When I'll tell you, if you spent that time with your top quartile, your average will be so much higher, and it's more fun.
Yeah.
It's so much more refreshing to do that.
Can we go back to the concept of skin in the game that you mentioned a few minutes ago? Because I've written and talked about this a lot over the course of my career. I've said that, you know, having the proper aligned financial incentives is, in most cases, a necessary condition for success, but it's not sufficient. You need psychological incentives, too. You need that passion for it. And I want you to speak to whether you agree with that, and then also how you thought specifically about what exactly is skin in the game. Because if we go, you know, I'll pick Cascade Investment, Bill Gates' office right now, you know, if they make a $50 million commitment to a fund, well, that's a lot of money. That's skin in the game. Wait a minute. What's the denominator?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Anyhow.
Well, you know, it was very off-putting for people to have early meetings with me because they'd have the deal book on the desk. And I would say, where are you from? What have you done? How much money did you make doing that? And I'd be sitting there constructing their balance sheet, you know, as they go. Now, how many kids do you have? And where do you live? And I'm sitting there doing cost of living, and I'm doing private school. I'm doing future, you know, college. I'm kind of doing a whole, you know, little model for them, you know, in my head. And I'm basically trying to see, okay, how much, before we get into this book, how much are you willing to put in?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it would say so much more to me than somebody who's made $50 million and says, I want to put in $2 million. Mm-hmm. If somebody's got $1 million and they want to put $800,000, that's very significant. Mm-hmm. So to me, the question was, are they willing to put meaningful skin in the game? So the word meaningful is the key.
Yeah,
and
meaningful you to them.
To them.
Yeah.
To them. And those people, there are certain people who are energized. Some people are off-putting or put off. If I ask, what's your network?
Yeah, exactly.
And if they didn't know their network, I helped them create it. Okay. And I said, I put in contingent liabilities, like, okay, your kid's college and you have a daughter, home, marriage. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a fun exercise.
Yeah.
There's a certain class of people out there who are energized by that conversation. And they say, I'm glad you asked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I didn't make as much on the last because I didn't have as much equity, or the person kind of messed me around at the end, or da 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 da. Or I made $4 million and I was so excited. Now I want to make 40. Okay. And this deal is so great. I'm cashing out this. I mean, I've had people sit in my office and say, I'm cashing this out. I'm taking my kids out of private schools. I'm cashing in my life insurance policy. I go, whoa, wait a minute. But they said, this deal is so good. I want to back up the truck and I'm looking for a partner. That is different than shifting all the risk to me.
Yeah.
Okay. And that, you know, I look at risk like a football. Okay. And in a meeting, the football's in the middle of the table. If somebody says, you know, my daddy told me I'd never go broke if I don't put any money in this in deals. But Ken, will you guys put in $10 million? That football just went in my lap. Okay. The person who says, I'm glad you asked, I'm scraping together everything I can. It's just too big for me and I need a partner. That football is more on their lap than it is on mine. It's going to be one part of my portfolio. It is their portfolio. So to me, again, this goes back to the earlier question. I can't evaluate risk in the energy business. I'm not a geologist. I'm not a geophysicist. I can't read a log. I can't look at a well log. I can't look at a P over Z curve, nothing. So if that football's in my lap, my hands are up. I'm like, I can't evaluate this. We're out.
Well, as per usual, you're being, in my estimation, excessively humble. And
well,
I want to use that as a segue to talk about a different set of topics. Because I can't remember exactly the years that these conversations began unfolding with you about the all-important question of how does humanity adapt? In addition to reducing carbon emissions, how do we adapt? Because you had extraordinary prescience in saying, you know, adaptation is going to be at least as big a problem and a challenge as reduction. So I want you to describe for members of our audience who don't really know exactly what you undertook, how you pressed the case for adaptation when you started doing that. And then in all candor, I think we can say in hindsight that many elements of that campaign that you undertook just simply didn't succeed. I would say it's because you were before your time.
Right.
But go ahead and take a few minutes to talk.
Sure, sure.
And bring us right up to date, too, with your current thinking.
Okay, sure.
But at adaptation.
Well, when all the climate, you know, I was influenced by Bjorn Lomborg when I lived in London in the mid-2000s. And there was all the talk about the Copenhagen meetings and all these fancy meetings that were happening around the world to talk about climate. And this was in 2007-08. And I looked at the numbers and said, this isn't going to happen. Primarily because The installed base of fossil fuels, of fossil fuel use is just too great. Okay. So if you believe the models, and I wasn't denying the models, I'll grant the models, but the world is going from 6 billion people to 9 billion people. Now it's at 8. So roll back, you know, we've added since the year 2000, we've added 1 billion people to the planet. And the, we've added 2 billion people. The number of people increasing in middle class consumption patterns, eating beef, the number of gadgets. I mean, just everything up the development curve increases energy consumption, period, full stop. The world's increasing population, full stop. I said, you can lower consumption per dollar of GDP, lower consumption per capita, and the capita's going up. You're not bending the curve.
Yeah.
And I said, no amount of money is going to do this because the technology doesn't exist.
Exactly.
And we're working from too small a base. You got to think about big, chunky stuff. And the world was working on a presumption that 196 countries need to agree. Okay. And I hate to break it to you, but 190 of those countries are irrelevant.
They don't matter.
Okay. They don't matter.
Yeah, their emissions don't.
I was on a panel in Davos with the head of the negotiator from the UN who worked on this. And she said, where'd you get these numbers? I said, from you. I mean, I didn't make any of this stuff up. And I said, you know, if we just worked on reducing Chinese and U.S. coal consumption, we could have bent the curve, really. But instead, we spent 20 years trying to get 196 countries to agree, and you can't get 196 countries to agree on what they're going to have for breakfast, okay? But that's the route we went. At the same time, I said, there's no way the public sector can do this. There isn't enough money on the planet. There isn't enough tax dollars on the planet, even if you could get that coordination to actually implement new renewable energy that didn't exist. I mean, I just looked at it and said, it's a math problem, and it's not going to happen. And so I said, what's going to need to happen is what human beings are incredible at. We're incredible at adapting. I said, why should this generation be the first generation in human history to adopt the turn back the clock strategy?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I said, we should be working on new things to be more gentle on the planet, and we need to adapt. Okay. But there's all sorts of things that conspire to the adaptation strategy. But I said, listen, if you believe the models and countries that had arid land are now going to be non-farmable, that's how migrations happen. And that's when machetes come out and genocides happen. I said, we're going to be in a problem, and it's going to be too little too late. So we need to adapt. And so I took it upon myself to create the Global Adaptation Institute, and we funded it. And we hired really good people to think about ways to discuss and change the narrative around adaptation, because Bjorn Lomborg was told by Al Gore that he's a denier. Mm-hmm. He's not a denier. He's an acceptor.
Yeah.
He's just saying, listen, it's a better bet. I don't care about the year 2100 if we're not going to get there.
Yeah.
Let's work on getting there first, and then we can work on it. And so let's work on the big, chunky stuff, and then let's make sure that human beings on this planet are adapting to climate change. We can adapt, okay? Fossil fuels did not take a gentle environment and make it hostile. Fossil fuels took a hostile environment and made it gentle.
Yeah.
We'd last 72 hours out there without fossil fuels.
Exactly.
Okay? And so we got to understand that humanity is where it is, and modernity is where it is because of cheap, reliable, plentiful energy. Okay? If you add clean to it and you take away reliable and you take away plentiful and you take away cheap, you're going to push people way down the development curve, and the have-nots are going to say to the haves, wait a minute, you had your century, we want ours.
Yep.
And that's what's transpiring. So I saw all this coming. I went to my investors and said, listen, this is the easiest investment decision of all time. Coastal protection, water, and agriculture.
Yeah.
Okay?
Hi, I'm Keith McCullough, and I wanted to introduce you to my favorite product at HedgEye, The Macro Show. Why is it my favorite product? Well, it's my show. I do that every morning. If you want to get ready for the market day, you want to contextualize all the data, you want to make good decisions, then this is what you should be watching. It's a repeatable process that you can deliberately study, measuring and mapping time series to time series of data So it's not going headline to headline and getting whipped around. It's actually being so much more dispassionate about it and making good decisions that are data-driven. So we'd love to have you on our team. Come join us.
Tune in weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern and on demand anytime. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe.
And including in the latter genetic engineering.
Yeah. And I said,
the better you.
And this is not related just to climate change. It has much more to do with mass urbanization because of development and the world's population going up.
Yeah.
The climate changing only makes all that stuff more exaggerated.
Mm-hmm. You're saying it's at a time where we're at this point a few years after China's admission to WTO and that giant sucking sound you heard.
Correct.
People moving into urban environments to work.
This was in 2010.
Exactly.
And I basically couldn't get the fund raised. You know, if I had all the money in the world, I would have done it, but I didn't. And my investors, who I thought were going to, say, this is great because you want to go to where the puck is going, you know, and they, you know, everybody wants to be the first one to do it the 10th time. I mean, nobody wanted to be the first one. And this, and
with some exception.
Okay. And so, you know, we ended up with a small little agriculture fund, but you know, when I look at where we sit today, the world has spent $6 trillion on renewable energy in the last 20 years. Fossil fuels has gone from 84% market share to 82%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why? Demand growth. And so it would have been higher had we not.
Yeah.
However, the consumption patterns and the demand equation is growing too fast. And now we're trying to electrify everything. And now you look at AI, you know, and Bitcoin. I mean, now you look at where the world is moving up that demand curve. We're not going to catch up, and we're now realizing that we need to adapt. But the money is way behind the time.
So let's spend we've got maybe 15 minutes or so left, and let's spend most of that, if not all of it. I have one closing question that's much more personal, but on these larger forces, right? Because I want to do account of what you just said. You suggested earlier, rightly, because it's served by my memory, certainly, that at one point in its evolution, NGP was basically overcome by forces way beyond itself, right? Geopolitical and the implosion of Russia, LTCM and the like. And a lot of people listening to us talk are thinking a lot about these large forces. Let's start with the question that's a direct segue from what you just talked about. A little bit unfair, but if you were czar of the universe, what would you do at this point? Would you take all of mankind's available resources and throw it at fusion, fission? I take it.
Energy? Or
yes. I'm just talking about energy.
So let me...
Energy and adaptation.
Got it.
They're opposite sides of the
correct. And let me just say, qualify my prior comments. My prior comments were as it relates to the macro standpoint of climate change,
yeah,
and what can really move the needle on emissions, okay, the way we're approaching it. That's not to say that there aren't great investment opportunities in the alternative energy space, right? You might be a great healthcare investor,
yeah,
and you're attacking, you know, problems with the retina. You're not going to change cancer survival rates in global health, okay? But you may make a fascinating rate of return in the ophthalmology business, okay? So we have to distinguish between investing and actually the climate change,
yeah,
right? I would say the number one thing to do is carbon sequestration.
Mm-hmm.
Period, full stop.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
Because that, it will get us to the year 20 whatever, mm-hmm, so we can get to the year 21 whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. And I would throw everything at carbon sequestration,
because mm-hmm,
that would buy us so much time.
Mm-hmm.
We would then have the luxury of stopping and saying, okay, what should be the future of mankind?
Mm-hmm.
Where should we live? What areas are, you know, are the most hospitable, and move there,
yeah,
you know, and make that happen.
So
I mean, that really is, because it, you know, we emit carbon, right? And so we're trying to stop emitting carbon, but we have 100 years of installed base of modernity on that question, and we're not going to emit carbon, and we're going to have to replace it with something. But until we replace it with something that can scale and be reliable, and That's the continuity coming to the fruit,
correct. But it takes time to do so.
Sequestration technology exists.
No, I was just going to ask about that. Would that be something you think would be best done by strictly the private sector, by the public sector, or by a kind of combination effort by the two?
It has to be a combination.
Yeah. Can't be done by the public sector alone.
No.
In your estimation.
No. Yeah. Well, the carbon is being emitted by privates. Yeah. It has to be transported.
Yeah.
It has to be sequestered. So you have to find the caverns and you have to find the places to sequester it.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We have an emissions problem.
Yeah.
Attack emissions.
Let's talk for a minute or two. You do the talking. I'll just put the question to you about the history, the evolution, and the current status of the offset.
The carbon offset market?
Yeah.
It's a mess because it has to be global. And if it's not, Mother Nature doesn't know the difference between Chinese carbon and US carbon, right? And so all we're doing is shifting you're giving incentives to shift where the emissions come from.
Yeah.
Period, full stop. I mean, if we need plastic, it's got to get made somewhere, right? And if somebody needs more emission, it does do it in a place where they have emission credit, fine. I mean, but the plastic still gets produced. It's nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a market grab and a market manipulation. And it's a way for the developed world to feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that in micro places it helps. I don't want to throw the babies out with the bathwater, but in terms of the climate, unless it's done on a global basis, it's not going to matter.
Changing topics rather completely, although there is a segue. Actually, many people watching this will know that you were a classmate, I think it was a class of 89 at GSB at Stanford, of the great Bill Browder. And they will certainly know of Bill and have read the books. I want to put a two-part question to you. What is your current assessment of where Putin and that regime is and where it might be headed? And this may sound like an unrelated topic. To me, they're actually opposite sides of the same coin. What would you have to say about MBS in Saudi Arabia and where they're headed as a regime? And would you draw an almost moral distinction between the two regimes, or do you put them in the same bucket?
Oh, they're not the same bucket at all. Vladimir Putin is a revisionist power working to restore the greatness of Russia. Not the USSR, not a group of Soviet republics, but actually Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a combination of territory and ideology and religion. And what he has done with the Russian Orthodox Church to convolute it into some sort of a narrative to give himself the stamp of approval, godlike stamp of approval, is dangerous. But that's clear.
Mm-hmm.
The solution there are the people of Russia. And I don't know, I don't know what that tipping point will be, but they had 30 years of watching the game of freedom, democracy, and capitalism being played,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And now there was a lot of kleptocracy that concentrated that well, but the lessons are there,
mm-hmm.
and the systems are there, and Putin's not going to live forever. So that's the question. But they may very well fall into line and say, we're the great Russia. I mean, I don't know. I really, you'll have to ask the Russian historians, to kind of make a projection about the nature of the Russian culture and people. But that's what Vladimir Putin is trying to do. Mm-hmm. They have all the resources that they need. They are a nuclear power. They have a source of funds coming out of the ground. They have all the ingredients to be either good or evil. And he believes that the Western way of life is a threat, and wants to restore that proper place of Russia. I feel like that he feels Russia was emasculated when it broke apart, Soviet Union broke apart, and he's got this destiny to be that historical figure to reassemble,
mm-hmm.
Which is dangerous.
Yeah.
MBS is playing a different game. I mean, I think he's playing a game of what happens if the world no longer needs our oil.
Mm-hmm.
I think that regionally they have 30 million people, and they are they look at their economy and say, Dubai's getting all this attention, Abu Dhabi's getting all this attention. They got a few million people. What's happening here?
Mm-hmm.
And so he realizes if I let half the population work, i.e. the women, amazing things can happen, right? And so he's balancing modernity with his traditions, but looking out, what can a model be in 30 or 40 years? I think it's a Singaporean kind of view of maybe not as open as Singapore, but I think it's leaning in that direction of how can Saudi Arabia be relevant in the world of 2050 to the year 2100 if oil demand falls, you know, by a third, or and the oil prices never go up because of that. I think he's playing a little defensive ball, and he's a younger guy and thinking about how can he play on that world stage.
It's so interesting you mentioned Singapore, so we can then mention Lee Kuan Yew and say, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, on strategy and execution as distinct scores, I'd give him a 10 in both dimensions. What's your assessment of when history looks back on MBS and his leadership, he might fall? Is he at the high end of the spectrum?
The jury's out.
Yeah.
I mean, if he can build a real educational base, I mean, right now, in my opinion, Saudi Arabia, they don't produce anything. Mm-hmm. They're purchasers. Okay. If they need great software, they put RFP out and get software.
Yep.
Okay. Then they might copy it and have people who go reverse engineer it, not to the extent of China, but they don't have an innovative economy. And it's understandable that that's the resource curse when you can pull your dollars out of the ground.
Yep.
So if he can create human capital and a culture of human capital, and you don't necessarily have to have private property rights the way we do. I mean, Singapore, you can actually keep what you earn.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are models out there that are not fully democratic, but you got to create an education system. You got to create a reward for innovation. And that's going to be the determinant. And building great buildings, you know, doesn't do it. Having sporting events doesn't do it. And I think that it's Abu Dhabi is building, you know, Abu Dhabi has culture, you know, they purchased it, but they, you know, they want people to come to Abu Dhabi. They have art, they have medicine, they have, they want to be a player on the world stage. They have big global brands that are there. I mean, that's the Abu Dhabi formula, but they don't have the population base.
Mm-hmm.
So the secret for MBS is to ignite his people. And the first step is the women.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taken that step. And how do you create that human capital, that drive for ingenuity, and you got to let people keep what they are.
And how troubled are you by the fact that he just outright murdered a journalist?
Terrified. Mm-hmm. Terrified. For all the obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Because you have to have some level of, you know, of openness. Mm-hmm. You have to have some level of competence.
That's what it is,
right? And a country that can laugh at its, you know, that can laugh at its leader. This is a quote from George W. Bush.
Yeah.
You know, that Saturday Night Live made a living off of, you know, poking fun at him, and he said, you know, a nation that can laugh at their leaders is a confident nation, is a secure nation, is a free nation.
Yeah.
All right. And so you have to be good enough to withstand that.
Yeah.
So when he becomes good enough, he won't have to murder journalists, right? And looking at journalists as a mirror that you can learn from and improve upon is better than, you know, shooting them.
Yeah, I won't waste any of our remaining time by putting a series of questions to you about China. I'll just ask you to help us take 2 or 3 minutes to look at China through the same prisms that you just applied to Russia and to Saudi Arabia.
I mean, China was on a path that looked more like unleashing the entrepreneurial spirit was their future. Xi Jinping is going the wrong direction in my mind, because now he has gone from state-sponsored capitalism to just state-sponsored. And he has noticed that people who are wealthy are popular and people listen to them. And so he has to, one at a time, pick them off or get them to shut up.
Yeah.
And so he's playing the game of reestablishing control. He's doing what Putin's doing, but without territory. He's got enough territory.
Yeah.
I mean, Taiwan is his territory, you know, that is going to be it's going to be a lightning rod at some point. But he's got too much land. I don't know what he does with all his land.
Yeah.
But, you know, he and Putin are playing a very similar game.
Yeah.
They're revisionists, and if people die, if their own people don't move forward, in their mind, they're playing a bigger game. And that's scary.
Yeah, quite scary. So I'm going to come to my closing question. I mean, we could talk all day and into the evening, as we have often done in the past. But I actually have a standard set of closing questions, but I put them to you previously several years ago. And I'm going to skip over them for a very deliberate reason, because your life story, and I'll hold this up. I don't know if, Jared, if we can see this. This is Ken's sort of autobiography memoir. It ought to be required mandatory reading in every business school, if not every college in the country. I'll just say that. I'm not a sycophant, but it's extraordinary. So I'll encourage people to read that. When you do, you'll learn something about Ken Hirsch that is not obvious from talking to him in a context like this, which is that you had a pretty hard road to the point where you got into Rain Wanda's office and started working. I would say a lot of adversity. And the specific question I want to point to you, because you said earlier, in this feed the winners culture, you can't be fake about it. You can't have the kumbaya, everybody gets a participation trophy and an award, because people will sense the inauthenticity of that, and the whole culture will just degrade and erode. So how do you, and you can put it in the context of your own two children, or just more generally, if you don't want to get that personal, but how do you cause young people, as they're maturing, to undergo and experience the adversity that some of us might suggest, again, is an absolute prerequisite to later success?
That's a really good question.
You can't fake it. You can't say, oh, we're going to starve the child for 7 days so they know what it's like to go without food.
No, and you can't. And I think that the important thing with it is you have to be authentic, and you have to appreciate that to whom much is given, much is required. And that if you don't have the adversity and you've been born on second base, understand and appreciate it. But then there's the obligation. You better get to third as quickly as you can, and then come home and get up to bat again. Okay. And that there's something expected of you. And that is unique to every circumstance. And I would say that the best way to do that is to model the behavior. Okay, I am not a morning person. My best time would be 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. That'd be my best day, okay? But I wanted to get up at 6 in the morning so that I was sitting at the breakfast table, paging through the Wall Street Journal, talking about my day, so that my kids, when they came down for breakfast, would see me there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then even when my kids were driving and they came down the stairs and blew past me into the garage, they saw me. One time my daughter asked me, Dad, she was a young teenager. She says, do you still need to work? And I said, no, I don't need to work, but I want to work.
Yeah.
And she had this look like, huh, you know, because if I didn't need to work, I couldn't work. And you could just see that it was clicking. And I think that's the best thing to do. When I started at the Bush Center, my car was the first one in the garage. I wanted it to be the first one in the garage for my first 6 to 8 months there.
Yep.
I wanted people to see.
Bosses here.
And be the last car in the garage.
Yeah.
As we were leaving.
Yeah.
And that to me is all I can say is to model it. David, I've known you a long time, David, and you are one of the most thoughtful, careful, introspective people I've met. And you're the same right now as you were 30 years ago when we met for the first time. And you modeled that. And so people will follow that, and they'll stop and they'll say, am I doing the right thing? And there are times when I'm in the room and I'd say, what would Richard do? You know?
Yeah.
And you just, that's all I can say. Go model great behavior.
Yeah. I very much appreciate those kind words. Again, I'm going to say for the second time, this is a fabulous book. I'm going to close with an anecdote from it, because I can imagine when you think back to the scene in this book, which you describe in detail, where you're sitting in the bursar's office at Princeton with your sister, and they say, we haven't gotten the check from your family. You need to leave. I mean, I get chills just talking about it. I was weeping as I was reading it for the first time in draft form, as you recall. And now I'm going to say, where's the World Series ring? Because have you got it with you?
Only because I'm going to the game tonight.
Exactly. Because what I'm...
What does that have to do with the bursar's office?
It has everything to do with it. Could you ever have imagined, as you were sitting there with your sister, that one day you'd be the co-owner of a Major League Baseball team and then wind up with one of these? because the team ended up winning the World Series.
You mean
that's the next?
You mean the Texas Rangers that won the World Series in 2023?
Yeah.
What? The little Texas Rangers? Unbelievable. No, I couldn't. But that's not, you know, to me, that was, I didn't even know this world existed.
Yeah.
My parents were economic professors. My mom was an economics professor. My stepdad was an economics professor who taught, you know, the history of economic thought, you know, Marx and Engels and Hayek, and, you know, that's what he was teaching.
Yeah.
And my father was a podiatrist. Yeah. I mean, and that, I didn't know Wall Street existed.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
And so that, to me, it was a process of discovery.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to ask about taking my clothes off at Rainwater's funeral, but that's in the book. You'll have to read that.
I will.
But the story, the story of getting stopped, there's a little pink slip on the computer punch cards as we get to the registrar. It said, go to the registrar on sophomore year when I was enrolling for classes freshman year in the fall at Princeton. I didn't even know where the registrar's office was. It was in a big, tall building down south of campus. So I went there. And my sister, who was a rising senior, was sitting there too. And she got the same slip, paperclip. And it turned out that we owed the $6,000 for the semester each, so $12,000. And I called my father, called his office, and I said, and it was his agreement as part of the divorce that he would pay education. And he said, I can't pay it. He said, listen, I got you through 12 years at private school, and I got you through 2 years at Princeton, and I just can't do it anymore. And that was it. And so my sister looked at me, and I just had this thought. I was like, how much do I have in my checking account? And I had $12,000 in my checking account from my summer.
Yeah, in the bonds.
And summer, and, you know, and just that was it. I had 12 and change. I mean, it was like a weird story. The fact that the number was 12,000, I had 12,000 and something. And I wrote a check. And my sister was like, where the hell did you get $12,000? But, you know, I said, that's not important. Let me just pay it. Anyway, we'll figure it out later. And which we did. But I knew right then that I had this feeling. I had two feelings. One was pride. I was like, I have $12,000. I can do this.
Earned by yourself.
Yeah. It was mine.
Earned it, yeah.
And when I look back on it, I was like, wow, I had this feeling of just, you know what? I am never going to not be self-reliant.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it started right there.
Yeah.
And it was just like, you know what? But it's not like, oh, I'm going to go make a bunch of money. It was like, work hard, save, you know, be careful. And I mean, that was what I was going to, go to law school at the time, you know, I was going to be a lawyer. But that to me was the lesson, it was prideful. It was a little bit of like, oh crap, you know, what's going to happen? But then it was, I can do this. And that feeling has stuck with me.
Yeah.
And to your prior question, how, you know, with my kids and with kids of people that come from comfort, we've already cheated our kids out of that satisfaction of, you know, or making it, okay? Let's not cheat them out of the satisfaction of being self-aligned.
Yeah.
And figure out the right way to do that. Because it's personal to everybody. If there isn't one size fits all. But for us, we made our philanthropy public, and we did it to signal to our children that we're not just going to leave it all to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I started getting more satisfaction. One of the reasons I wanted to find a second life and to move on from NGP was I was getting as much satisfaction out of my philanthropy and my nonprofit life as I was out of fund management.
Yeah.
The fun had been taken out of fund management. and so it was just time. And so I was honest with myself, but that part of our rationale for doing it publicly was to signal to our kids, and it worked. You know, they said, are you going to give away all our money? And we looked at each other and said, we might.
This is a great note on which to end. Ken, thank you for your time. I very much appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
Sounds good chatting with you. You're a champ.
Don't forget to check out HedgeEye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @HedgeEye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by HedgeEye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. HedgeEye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of HedgeEye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by HedgeEye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.